You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. The podcast today is with Mo Bonnell, who helps complex organizations grow by scaling business development skills across their organizations and creating a growth-oriented culture. He's the author and the host of the video podcast Real Relationships, Real Revenue, and the founder of Bonnell Idea Group. They've trained tens of thousands of seller experts at over 400 clients all over the world. But he's got a new book, and that book is called Give to Grow, Invest in Relationships to Build Your Business and Your Career. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Mo Bonnell, welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, I'm excited. Like, we know so many people in common, and it's going to be, I love your content and all that we're going to cover today.
All right. Well, I hope you love my first question, because I don't normally blow the whole point of a book with my first question, but I'm about to. I know we have so much to talk about, so I'm not worried about this, but your premise, and it's something I agree with 100%, is that success in work and in life is all about relationships.
Yeah. Well, I just think there's so many books out there that are about success at the expense of relationships. You know, there's, and I'm doing air quotes here, but yeah. Like there's sales books and there's great ones. I mean, I've read a million. I love it. But so many don't mention the relationship at all. Or if they do, it's about manipulation. Like it's explicitly, How do you get the person to sign on the bottom line? And I just completely disagree with all that. I think in life, the relationship should always be paramount. I mean, I can't even think of a scenario when it's not, like literally 100% of the time. Yeah. But here's the trick is, how do you develop a relationship where it's not just Pollyanna running through the fields throwing daisies, but developing relationships in a way that helps others, but also can help you build a book of business, drive positive change, being somebody that helps set the agenda and makes positive impact in the world. That's what I think the interesting conversation is.
Yeah, because this book, you talk about empathy and you talk about feelings and you talk about stories, all the things that are, you know, we talk about in this podcast, many of which with artists and with psychologists and everything. But I think the unique point of view is you're an actuary.
Yeah.
Who's writing a relationship book.
Think about how your career's gone at this point, Kelly. You're interviewing an actuary, teaching you about like things just hit an all time low.
No. I'm going to say it's an all time high. So let's thread this needle though. So how does an actuary get to writing this kind of book?
Well, I think it is fun to bring up. Obviously, I don't practice as an actuary anymore, but earlier in my career was just on rails. Because when you take the exams to become an actuary, the failure rate's almost 2/3. Like the pass rate on the exams is like 36-37%. At the time I took them in the 80s and 90s, you had to take 24 of these things to become a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, the highest designation, which I did. And you pop out the other end of 7, 8, 9, 10 years studying, and you've got this designation, and you haven't basically been able to do anything but study and keep your marriage together and work. And so the month I passed that last exam, I'd orchestrated a move with the big consulting firm, big global firm I was with, where because I was an actuary with a personality, which, you know, we can make lots of jokes about that. It's a low bar. But they moved me into this very, very senior relationship development role. And everything changed at once, Kelly. Like my incentive mm-hmm. changed, how I got my bonus changed. I was now hooked to originations and growth and things like that. And because the only move I knew was studying, I studied. I was used to taking exams every 6 months. So I put this pressure on myself to somehow cram 20 years of learning in, because most of my peers were in their 50s and I'm 30 or whatever. I put this pressure on myself to learn all that stuff in 6 months. So I just crammed and I started to cobble together a system of what does psychology and behavioral science and neuroscience say about developing relationships, building a book of business, getting a yes in a positive way, shaping the world. And that first 6 month sprint then has turned into a lifetime of me studying this exact thing. So is this, to put a bow on all that, it was this really weird scenario and culmination of events where I felt tremendous pressure. I only knew one thing, which is how to study. I had this new role and I had to figure it out. I put pressure on myself to do it. And that basically through that, I fell in love with relationship development, had success, and then went through a transformation where I started our company 20 years ago. And now we've trained 50,000 people on these skills, these relationship-centric things that drive growth.
So the sweet spot there, of course, is combining knowledge and practice. It is the ability to be in this sort of flow state, right? So you're working just a little bit, maybe beyond where your knowledge and practice that is. So, and I bet, like me, you were doing all this without any idea that that was the thing you were supposed to do.
Yeah. So in the beginning, it was just, I was like trying things, like testing things on myself. I had no idea this would be something else somebody else wanted. I was just like taking notes to myself. Some things worked, some things didn't. I'd keep the things that worked and ditch the things that didn't. And over time, just had a lot of momentum and success to the point where inside my company, people started asking like, hey, how are you doing that? Like I saw that big win. I saw that you did this thing. And through that, I just fell in love, not just with relationship development, but teaching others how to do it. And that's when I finally got up the guts to start my own company and just focus on that.
So a couple of weeks ago when the Democratic National Convention was here, a bunch of our old friends were in town, including Stephen Colbert, who was doing a show live from the Auditorium Theater. And a friend of mine who was at the show, I was not at the show because it started at 11:30 p.m. And that is too late for me at this point in my life. But a friend of mine was there and Stephen was taking questions from the audience. And he asked Stephen what was the number one gift that he got from his time at Second City. And Stephen gave an answer I've heard him give before, and it was the loving to learn the bomb. So that idea of the gift of failure, the gift of struggle, which he learned at Second City to embrace it, laugh at it, but use it. And you talk in the book, you say, quote, looking back, I'm thankful I had the gift of struggle. So what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it was that initial pressure pushed me beyond anything I thought was possible. And then the thing I built for myself turned out to be a thing that other people wanted. I think more meta around that is that life is like, if everything was perfect, what kind of life is that? It's engaging when we do have struggle to figure out that old saw of like, sometimes you lose or sometimes you win, sometimes you learn sometimes. And I think that's interesting. And I think when we think about relationship development, always tacking something on to the end of a meeting, like, hey, Jane, you said that workshop went great. What I just want to learn from this. It's great. It went great. But what stuck with you? Or asking a question like, hey, Jane, that I'm really glad that had a big impact on the team. But I just always want to learn. Give me one thing to change and one thing to keep. I'm really cool. What's your number one change and your number one keep? I'm really curious. Somehow always adding things like that into conversation, that helps this learning really happen. So whether something didn't go well or did, it's always a learning opportunity. And what's interesting about our topic, Kelly, is that deepens the relationship. It says, yes, I care about you. I see you. I value your opinion. And by always integrating learning with what we're doing, no matter how it went, then we're just on this exponential growth curve to have a bigger impact.
So my friend Piero, who I work with at Second City, and my wife does this too, they will often make fun of me in terms of I wrote a book called Yes And. It did very well. We teach a Yes And exercise. But they're constantly reminding me that, like, you know, it's not the words. Like, it's a mindset. And of course it is. And that's the same thing with the give to grow concept as well, right?
It's exactly that. I think what's interesting about a relationship-centric approach is a lot of people can come to the wrong conclusion, just totally get it wrong, which is, oh, yay, relationships, you're going to give, treat others how they want to be treated, platinum rule, run through the fields with daisies, things like that. And the research shows, and this is by everybody's favorite, Adam Grant, like yeah. If he's not your favorite, he should be researcher in the world. But when he did a study at Wharton, he found that not only are the people who give, who are sort of net givers, otherish, I call those strategic givers, not only are those people the most successful in life, but there's a big chunk of people who give first that are the least successful in life. So our two old saws of givers gain is true, and knights, nice gals and guys finish last. That's also true. So we had to do further work to figure out what's the difference. And the difference is the people who are on the successful end of the spectrum of givers, and they also looked at matchers and takers that are in the middle, but the successful givers, the strategic givers, are people who scale the size of their investment relative to what they might get. Now, there's still never a string attached with a gift of insight or expertise or starting a project on your dime or whatever it is. There's never a string attached. That's really important in this research, but you size the scale of your gift or your investment relative to what might happen to you. And I think what's interesting about that, Kelly, to close it out, is this idea of giving and having a relationship first is really important. We also have to know how to scale the gift we're giving. We also have to know when to say no so we don't get burned or get burned out. But it's the people who are always strategically thinking about what can I invest in, who should I invest in, and how. Those are the people who get ahead.
So the thing I think about, too, when we talk about that, that the many sort of nuances of that sort of giving personality and where it can go awry. My friend Allison Fregale, who we just had on the podcast, wrote a book called Likeable Badass.
All that, yeah.
For women in leadership. But the thing that she talks about that I think is germane here is the quality that she says that women in particular need, but I think it's true for men, which is you need to have both warmth and assertiveness.
Yes.
So this idea of this competence, but also with warmth. And we've seen, you know, her idea is like, if it's just warmth, you're kind of maybe a patsy. If it's just assertiveness, you're a jerk. And so, you blend both. But I think that is true with this giving personality is that, and it's that thing that's very hard for Western cultures in particular to hold on, who tend to want one thing, whereas Eastern cultures always understand there's at least two things going on at any given time. Does that resonate with you?
Totally. One of the pages in Give to Grow that people have liked the most is, and you might have seen this, there's two beautifully, like our designer for the book was amazing. Like it's such an accessible book because you have big font and using graphics and things like that. And there's some facing pages in the book near the end of section one where there's a table and it shows that doing the work and the activities that you do when you've already got the yes, whether it's external client project or it's internal project as somebody's a leader in a big company, doing the work aren't just different mindsets and moves from winning the work, getting the next yes. They're not just different. They're the exact opposite. And this aligns with what you just shared a lot. The doing of the work activities are about assertiveness. You're driving to certainty. I know that I'm the expert. I know how to get it done. I'm going to get us done on time and under budget, doing the work activities. But we also have to be giving. The winning of the work activities are not about certainty. They're about possibility. Mm. How do we go into those conversations not with a huge PowerPoint deck about how great we are? That feels sold to. Nobody's waking up in the morning saying, gosh, I wish somebody would come in with a PowerPoint deck and tell me how great they are. Nobody. But if we can go in with a blank page with great questions, fall in love with their problem, use our expertise to show them that there's some untapped potential that we can help them get to, those are more of the generosity, the winning of the work activities. And back to the point, it's having one or the other, like you shared, isn't good. Only being the expert without relationships, you're a jerk. Only have relationships without expertise, you're fun to go to the Cubs game with, but that's about it. And people don't have as much time for that anymore. It's when you can pair both. I've got expertise that's going to help you, and I'm enjoyable to work with. I'm going to have your needs weighted above mine. The relationship's paramount. The person that blends both the doing of the work with the winning of work, they're the ones that'll change the world.
I'm curious for you. It took me a long while to understand that duality in a work context. When I look back and I'm like, well, I understood it when I was reading about Buddhism in college. I understood it in a lot of my personal relationships. But I wonder why, you know, what is this chasm that exists between these things that we learn about life writ large that somehow we think when we open up this other door to walk through our business, we don't take into account?
This is a huge topic and it's so important. Here's what happens is in every single organization on the planet, there are methods and there is feedback loops and there are ways to teach the doing of the work activities. So anybody listening, they can probably think of, oh, there's training classes, there's mentorship. Just doing the work makes you better at doing the work because you get quick feedback loops. Now let's compare that to the winning of the work activities, the relationship ones. It's totally random. Who has training classes on this? Hardly anybody, right? And also the feedback loops are very rare and irregular. It can seem random. Wow, we just landed this big project because my friend from B school landed at this other organization and brought us in. Or we lost work because somebody else had a better relationship. It can appear to be random, but relationships are not random at all. It's the people who take relationship development and view it as a discipline in its own right, continue to invest in people, sort of the investment world. If we dollar cost average, if we're always investing in our relationships, that pays off over the long haul. And that just erases the randomness that can happen. We might get a little lucky here, a little unlucky there. But you show me the person that's invested in relationships consistently over a year, a decade, two, they're the ones that are going to shape the world. That's a skill in its own right. It can be learned. And it's probably the most important skill most people get after they start to learn their core expertise.
So at what point in your career did that insight like crystallize?
I think it was at that moment where I popped out of the actuarial exams and in one weekend moved to a relationship or business development role. We called it managing consultant at my firm. Yeah. So in those 2 days, I felt, I know this is ridiculous to think, but you know, at the age I was at the time, I really felt like I needed to learn 2 decades of an experience right away.
Okay.
I was now managing our hundreds and hundreds of offerings. I was connecting with people that were C-level executives at companies. They were in their 50s. I'm 30 or whatever I was.
Yeah.
So I couldn't, it was so scary, Kelly, because I couldn't rely on actuarial mumbo jumbo anymore. Like I could, you know, the Friday before I could say, hey, yeah, our model does this and here's our sensitivity testing and all this. Like I was really good at actuarial work and it's almost hidden behind a curtain in a way. People just like, they don't want to look at the model. They just want to tell you what it means. Yeah. But all of a sudden that next Monday, I couldn't lean on expertise. So the only thing I could do was ask for generosity or to offer generosity. So I would run around our firm and talk internally and say, hey, if I can get us a meeting with so-and-so, what would you give them to start the relationship off right? Oh, well, I would let them see our new database that isn't even revealed yet. And I would show it to them or I would give a speech or what? Okay, great. Let me go offer that to her. And I just used generosity over and over strategically. And it worked really well. And that I realized that's the expert generosity or strategic giving is the expertise to bolt on to core expertise. And that's the two together where all the power is.
Such a gift. So there's so many people that, as you mentioned, right when we started that crossover. But there's a few that you introduced me to. Victor Ottati. Is that his name?
Am I saying yeah. That? Yeah.
This idea of earned dogmatism. Love the phrase. Explain to our audience what that is.
Yeah, well, it's so fascinating. So Ottati validated a mental heuristic, first person to do it, called earned dogmatism. And in a nut, it's super scientific and all that. But what the audience needs to know is the more we believe our expertise is really strong, the more closed-minded we become. Well, this is really interesting because when we think of that, if we think of the doing of the work or the expertise stuff, because we've seen the movie so many times before, we can actually step on relationships because let's say we meet a new potential client. They have an issue. We've solved this one 17 times in the last 3 months. We can actually get closed. We're actually biased towards being closed-minded. and not doing something that we call, you saw the chapter on this, fall in love with their problem. And we've got to force ourselves not to assume we know the answer. Dig in, ask questions. Even if we do know the answer, we need to have them have the experience of sharing what their perspective is so they know we get it. And it's so easy to, one of the biggest traps we want to avoid is thinking we know the answers before the person feels like we understand them. That's earned dogmatism, or that's the mental heuristic. And if we can avoid that, it's almost like we're walking around in a minefield with clown shoes on. If with earned dogmatism, because we're like, we think jumping to the conclusion is the right move, but we can just be blowing up all over the place. The prospect's like, I don't want to use them. They're pushing something on me. I don't feel like they get me. Things like that. We've got to slow down, ask all the right questions, validate we actually do know the situation, and give them the great experience of explaining that to us, and we paraphrase it back to them. It's when we paraphrase something back to them where they feel like they get me, that's when they're receptive to our ideas, and not before.
So it strikes me that the darker version of that is the Dunning-Kruger effect,
we think we're better.
Yeah, we think we're better than everyone else when they know these things. And when I learned about that instantly, I was like, oh, I got to be careful, because I do think I'm an expert in a variety of areas, and that's going to make me blind to things. And that's a very you really have to draw on humility that is not easily accessible, especially as you age and have success, because people, and this is the whole point of this, right? Which is like, people will give you things. People will give you a pass at a certain place when you don't necessarily deserve it. I go to a lot of these innovation conferences, and if I'm doing a Q&A, people always be like, what's the biggest barrier to success? And I'm like, past success for me.
Yeah.
It is really easy to do the same thing over and over again. And we know what happens when that occurs, which is, you know, that you start to have miss upon miss upon miss. That's really hard. Okay, one more. Teresa Amabile, who I do know her work because she has done some improv work before.
Oh, wow.
And Stephen Kramer, they talk about the progress principle. I thought this was fascinating. As you write in the book, quote, one thing correlated to both productivity and happiness, people that celebrated incremental progress. I think this is actually hugely important. So I don't want to slow down. I want to slow down on this idea. So I think what I'm hearing here is that one of the only places where you see productivity and happiness come together. So let's first stop there, because a lot of times when we're productive, we're not happy. Yeah. And sometimes when we're happy, we're not productive. I think everyone understands that. But this idea of celebrating incremental progress, what's that mean to you?
This is so worth slowing down on.
Yeah.
So when we think about, so let me set the table, because I think it'll really help. When we think about relationship development, because it can seem random, because the feedback is slow and irregular, because one relationship might pay off and another one might, as you continue to invest in it proactively, in that person proactively, it can be easy to assume that it feels like random acts of lunch, that we're just this isn't going to be helpful. Well, we all know that relationships are the key to future success. So we've got to actually pull the locus of control back to us. We've got to somehow find ways of rewarding ourselves based on the effort, the incremental progress, not the end result. A lot of our clients, the kind of things that they promote in the marketplace might take 6 months, a year, 2 or 3 years to actually come to fruition. That's really trait self-control. Like, that's really hard to stay on point. So to get to something really practical, if, for example, if we can say, hey, each week we're going to choose 3 MITs, air quotes around that, most important things, 3 most important things. Every week I'm going to choose 3 most important things when it comes to relationships, and I'm going to make that move. And we celebrate the fact we got 3 out of 3 this week, or we got 7 weeks in a row, or we've got 92% of our MITs done for a year, or whatever. If what we're doing there is we're pulling the control back into our efforts, we're saying that if we put in this effort, the results will come. And that's where people can celebrate incremental progress and feel like, to your point, not only am I happier, I did the hard work, but I'm more productive because that will pay off if I continue to invest in that way.
So here's how I think about this in terms of Second City. In the old days, and so I started here in the late 80s. Let me start with this. You get that on the stage because you get applause every night. So the simple act of you getting applause and bowing is what we're talking about. But and we were a smaller theater in the 80s. So when you worked here, though, there were pizza parties. There was, you know, other sort of things that would happen regularly, and we celebrated all different kinds of anniversaries. We were big on the rituals around celebration. I think we started to lose that as we got bigger in many ways. Again, not for the actors, because they had that sort of ingrained in what they did. Then COVID happened. Ooh. And I recall when we were much cut down, and there was maybe at this point, you know, 50, 60 of us who are working, we started doing a thing where, like, look, let's get on every Friday at 3 o'clock, because people were kind of at that point, you know, signing off. We did a 20-minute all company, and we celebrated wins for the week, because the wins were not, you know, it was tougher to come by there. Yep. And then occasionally we'd have, like, Alan Arkin showed up, you know, which was like the coolest thing for these people. And it was really powerful. And I think it was really useful, because it was in a moment of crisis that we realized we needed it. And now we're back, and we're back to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, and it's not there as much. So when I was reading about this, I'm like, wow. And it's not disconnected from Mike Norton's IKEA effect and other things that you write about and that we've talked about here.
Yep.
That you really do need to ritualize these things, not in inauthentic ways. And I think that's what you when you talk about celebrating success, it's like, how do we authentically do that shout out? And it can be just a shout out in a meeting, as you sort of pointed out. Yep. Are there other ways that you have found ways to do that don't feel like a, I don't know, that don't feel cloying or corporate?
Yep. Yes. So one of the most practical things that people love about Give to Grow is that, yeah, we give everybody the science. And I just love you're into this stuff too, because we can go deep.
Yeah.
But also the steps. So when it comes to relationships, by far the most important thing somebody can do is just write down on a scrap piece of paper their list of their most important relationships. Mm-hmm. We call that a protomoi list. It's that mispronounced, I'm sure. It's a Greek word. It means, it has no direct English equivalent. I love the definition, though. First among equals, or some people say first in order. A fluent Greek friend of mine said protomoi is how she learned to say it. So this idea of a first among equals list is hugely powerful. That's the number one thing. For most people, 10 relationships is going to determine their fate for their career and their happiness. Maybe 20, but not 100. Like you just can't
No.
keep up with that many. So if we can write down that list, scrap piece of paper. Most people do it in like 2 minutes. Like, you know who it is. It's not guesswork. And then say, what are these? What if I just try to be helpful to the, let's say it's 20 people. Let's just say each week I'm just going to try to be helpful to 3 of them. An article that they might like, I'm going to send that to Jane and Phil and Sue. Or an investment to do a half-day workshop in a client to really move the needle on something important to them, because I learned about that on a call we had, a coffee catch-up we had last week. If we can just do 3 moves a week like we talked about, that's for the most important people, that's 150 high leverage, really meaningful and mutually beneficial and helpful moves that we're doing a week or a year. 150 a year, 3 a week, 150 a year. That's going to create momentum. And then back to put a bow on all this stuff, if we can finally get to the answer to your question, if we can either celebrate those individually, like a walk around the block, a nice glass of wine, something that just says, hey, I know this is going to pay off. I'm just going to celebrate. I did my 3 moves this week. It's Wednesday night. I already got 3 done. This is amazing. Or to your point, as a team, could we develop everybody's list or our team's list collectively? And then we each do 3 things a week And we have a 10-minute call on Fridays that say, hey, what do we do this week that's helpful to our most important prospects, our clients, our internal stakeholders? That is A, fun. It celebrates incremental progress. So we're going to get productivity and happiness out of it. Everybody's going to start learning, like, oh, what'd you do with Phil, the CEO? That's a tough one. Oh, well, I sent Phil this thing. He already replied. He said he really liked it. So there's a way to do this individually that keeps us on track, productivity and happiness. And there's a way to do it as teams. One of the most powerful ways is as teams, just set the stage on this, describe what you want to do if you're a team leader, and ask the team, how can we celebrate this? What can we do? How can we really lean into this? The team will tell you. So, Kelly, that was a bit long-winded, but did I finally get around to your question?
Yeah. And again, you reference Wayne Baker, who's been on the podcast.
He's great. About, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you have strong ties and weak ties and dormant ties. And I think about this, like, absolutely, you can only cultivate so many relationships and you can only maintain them. Then there's Dunbar's number and there's all these sort of things.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, after having Wayne on the pod and reading his book, I really was like, oh, there's a very easy way for me to cultivate my weak ties, which is that list of people who I maybe have lunch with once a year.
Yeah,
that's it. And they're always totally happy to be contacted. And maybe it won't happen this year and it happens next year. And that's totally fine. And I just had a situation, too, where a guy who I was in touch with all the time, we lost touch for about 4 or 5 years for a variety of reasons. And we were sort of tossed back in the room. And he said to me, he's like, I feel such shame because I didn't keep in touch with you. And I'm like, don't feel that shame, because I could have picked up the phone call on my end. It's fine. And now we're working together on a project and it's like old times. It's like, oh, it's so easy to talk to him. I'm like, yeah, we've known each other for 25 years. You know, that's, and I think with that, and this goes back to Nick Epley's work, who we worked with at the University of Chicago, which is just, we just completely underestimate other people's potential interest in what's going with us, that also people aren't thinking about us all the time. they are maybe concerned with their own stuff. And so when they hear from someone who they considered a friend from an old time, but they're generally happy about it.
Yeah. Well, just to go a step farther down the path with you, because you brought up sort of a black belt pro ninja tip here, is if the baseline is, folks, write down your most important relationship. It takes only 2 minutes. Write down your top 10, top 20 max. Another level that you can go to, we could call this the I was trying to think of alliteration, like the Kelly system or the Kelly something, the Leonard language. I don't know. There's something cool here. But if we think of Dunbar's number, that about 150 is about the people that we can have a meaningful relationship with. Let's say somebody writes down 10 as their core. That's going to determine the fate of their future career. Well, what we might do for somebody that really wants to go to the next level is go ahead and spend a couple hours writing out the extra 140 people and then divide them up by 12 and say, once a month, I'm going to contact about 12 of these and I'm going to rotate throughout the year. So I would highly recommend, like, get your top 10 right and really lock that in. Do that for a couple of months till you know you can reach out to them and be helpful. And then if you want to go to these weaker ties one level out, then you could develop a system where you have a bigger number, whatever it is, you divide them up across the course of the year, and you just ping them once a year. That's an incredible 1-2 punch that leverages the value of the most important folks with the weak tie powers that you talked about, that Wayne and others know about. And that's like, that would be like the majors.
Yeah,
that'd be like 99th percentile.
Yep.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about actually just doing it. And of course, it's like, yeah, that's a really smart idea. Okay, before I ask you for a yes and story, let's talk about no. We had a relationship with a group in Japan called Yoshimoto, and I remember being contacted by a Chicago-based but U.S. agency. It was a federal agency, but it was all about, like, helping you communicate with these other cultures. And one of the things they told me, because they were well aware of the yes and philosophy at Second City, is they said, in Japan, when you do business, they will never say no. Ever. So you have to figure out, you know, and sometimes get years, oh, I'm not going to get a no, but I am not going to get a yes. And they're just not going to say it. So it was a very unique thing of being like, how am I looking for the signs? And you talk about, like, the worst thing you can be caught in is the slow no.
Yeah. It's so important. Like, I think people who are business developers or full-time salespeople or that in the business, there's this common myth that's said all the time, which is ask for the business or, you know, work people through a funnel. So have a discovery call and then ask at the end, can I send you a proposal? Well, that's a horrible idea because the person might not be interested at all. And many people are going to, yeah, sure, go ahead. Well, they have no skin in the game. You're going to go spend 20 hours writing this proposal, total people time. They don't even ever have to open it. They have no. So what we can do to avoid the slow no is add tons of value, give away everything that we can in the time we've got. Half hour call, man, you are teaching, you're sharing ideas, you're saying, would it be helpful if I blank? You're looking for helpful opportunities to introduce them to others or whatever it is. And then in that last 5 minutes, the number one thing that people need to do is make a recommendation. So for example, what most of our clients would do next is blank. When we're making that recommendation, we want to ask for some type of escalating commitment on their side. They got to have skin in the game. IKEA effect, yep. Michael Norton, just like you talked about. We buy into what we help create. So what we might do is say, hey, what most of our clients do next is have a 30-minute exploratory call where we actually sort of map out what this would look like together. A proposal would pop out the other side. Totally fine if this is a fit or not. I sense that we might be aligned, but I'm not sure the timing's right. Is that of interest to you or not? Well, if the person said, I'd love to do that, well, have the 30-minute call mapping things out, then send the proposal. They spent that extra 30 minutes with you with their sleeves rolled up. They bind to what they helped create. That's the yes. If they say no or him and haw, I don't know, it's really busy. I don't know if we have 30 minutes. I don't know if I could pull our CFO into that, whatever it is. That's great too, because there was no reason to spend 20 hours on the proposal because they won't spend 30 minutes helping you create some aspects of it. So the best way to avoid the slow no, make a recommendation. Make that recommendation, ask for a little bit of their time. And if they say yes, great. If they say no, great. What you're doing is avoiding the slow no, which is the death of everybody.
So there's one other thing I learned recently, and this study was published, I imagine, after your book was well sent in. And it's Vanessa Bonds, who I think you do mention in the book as well.
She's amazing. Yeah. Love her stuff.
Do you know about this no study that she did recently?
No. Tell me more. Teach me. This is great.
Yeah, it's really cool. So she brought in, so one group came in, and the scientist said to the person, okay, hand me your phone and unlock it, unlock your phone and hand it to me. I'm going to take it outside and do some stuff. If you don't want me to, that's fine. It won't affect your pay and the study. That's it. And normally, or overwhelmingly, people let them take the phone, and Ooh. Do whatever, which they shouldn't have. The other group, came in, they said, okay, can you open your phone, unlock it, hand it to me. I'm going to go outside and do some stuff. If you don't want me to do that, just say, Kelly, I don't want you to do that. That group didn't let them take the phone out. And what I was fascinated by with this is the idea of, like, in a space of yes and, when you're making something out of nothing, right, that's where that exists. However, when you want people to have their own sense of agency, when maybe you want them to give you a no, if they really mean that, you need to hand them a script.
Kelly, so, that's mic right? drop. Like, that's so good. Yep. And the slow no is the death, just to tie it back, is the death of everything. Like, because right. what it usually involves for people is a whole bunch of work on their part, and they were never going to get the yes anyway. So you got to test it. So having an exact script, making it okay to say no, is actually a brilliant move.
Yeah, just say, hey, you say to Kelly, say to me, no, that's totally fine, and we'll meet up later or whatever. And I just think that you know, I know people are afraid sometimes to do that because they want to hold on to this thing, but it's the same idea. This is the same idea with a young comedian who maybe is trying out for Second City and doesn't want to do their best bit because they're afraid it's going to get stolen. And my thought with that is, like, if all you have is one idea, you're never going to succeed in this business anyway. It's like, if it's one client or nothing, it does not matter. You know, throw it out into the universe, see what happens.
Yep. I totally agree. And just to put a bow on everything, if we were in that proposal situation at the end of a call, if somebody did want to send a proposal, they might pull in your idea from Bonds research. They might say, hey, I'm happy to send you a proposal, but honestly, feel free to say, no, I don't want to go back and write 20 hours if you're not interested at all. You can just say, Mo, tell me, like, this is not the good time. And yeah. I just love that. It's brilliant.
Yeah,
it's thank you.
Yeah. I've got to email her because I'm obsessed with this and I want them to do it. It was a small sample size, so I'd like to see more. All right.
Yeah.
We always end the podcast moving from no to yes and. We end the podcast with asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Well, I have a meta story. It was hard for me to think of this big life-changing event. I was putting a lot of pressure on myself because it's such a cool question. But what I realized as I was thinking about it, Kelly, is that everything's a yes and. So mm-hmm. like, yes, a client, I can come to that city and we can do a workshop. And the and might be, hey, who else do I know there I could have dinner with the night before? With a client, if we didn't win work, is there a yes and where we say, hey, could we have a debrief call? We learn why we didn't win the work. That's great. It's a sometimes you win, sometimes you learn scenario. But maybe the yes and is, and if you can share with me some of your future priorities, I'd like to continue to invest in our relationship, even though we didn't win this big one that we really wanted to help you on. Well, what a great relationship deepening move that is, you know? So I just think that if we can always be thinking about once we get a win, how can we make that win even better for the client? If we don't get what we want, how can we turn that into a learning opportunity? I just feel like there's always, if we tie back to the idea of it's always our move and it's always a chance to be helpful, I think there's a yes and in every single interaction that deepens the relationship. And I think that's what I'm always trying to think about is what it's so easy to blow in the winds of good news or bad news with other relationships. But if we can always think, whatever that is, it's my move and it's a chance to deepen the relationship. What's that and that's in there? I think that's the big unlock.
I think it's akin to the strategy around luck. You're making your own luck by doing something like
it. Yeah. I love that.
The book is called Give to Grow, Invest in Relationships to Build Your Business and Your Career. Mo Bunnell, thank you for coming on the pod.
Kelly, this has been so good. We're just like finishing each other's sentences. So thank you for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.